Good afternoon. It got very quiet, so I imagine that means it's time to start. Welcome to Theodore Parker Church. My name is Anne Bancroft. I am the minister here at Theodore Parker. We are delighted to be partnering this afternoon with RISE. Roslindale is for everyone, and Progressive West Roxbury Roslindale to offer this conversation today. I'm delighted to welcome Martin Henson and Carlene Griffiths-Sekou. They are joining us from the Black Lives Matter Boston movement. Race conversations in this country are never simple or easy. They are, however, imperative. Our failure as a society to rectify historical and continuing systems of inequality and injustice must be confronted. Our own Theodore Parker, abolitionist and ardent advocate of a government of all the people, for all the people, and by all the people, assured us that the arc is long, but we know it is our responsibility to do our part in bending it towards the justice of which he spoke. I am sure I speak for all of us with gratitude to our guests for bringing their voices into our midst. No doubt we will each be confronted with emotions that run the gamut from compassion to confusion and everywhere in between. I trust that we are each here to open our hearts with humility and with grace. In the spirit of love, all are welcome here. We say this all the time to each other in this church. In the spirit of love, all are welcome here. I want to introduce Jen Parks, who joins us from RISE, to say a few words.
Hi. Yes, my name is Jen Parks, and I want to, on behalf of RISE, Roslindale is for Everyone, thank you all so much for being here, and thank Theodore Parker for welcoming us to this beautiful space. Just a few words about RISE, if you haven't heard of us. Roslindale is for Everyone is a growing network of neighbors working to ensure that Roslindale is a safe home for all of us, inclusive of race, gender identity, sexual orientation, ability, religion, and anything else. RISE is working to resist oppressive policies and build the infrastructure our community needs so that we can all live dignified lives. We want to amplify the voices of the most impacted among us in order to address their concerns and protect those who have been targeted by hate. The group came together right after the election and quickly grew into a number of working groups. All are welcome to join said working groups. The topics that we're working on right now include racial and housing justice, working with elected officials, immigrant rights, democracy action, finding accurate news, small business outreach, monthly civic Saturdays, and block-level organizing. So you can check out our website, roslindalerise.org. We have a table in the parish hall as well. So after the event today, please come and visit us and join us because everyone is welcome. I'd now like to introduce Rachel Polliner from the Progressive West Roxbury Roslindale Group.
Hi there. It's great to see so many neighbors here. Thank you for coming out. As Jen said, I'm Rachel Polliner. I'm part of Progressive West Roxbury Roslindale. We're a chapter of Progressive Mass, which is a growing network of chapters across the state, working in a coordinated way, mostly, to press for progressive policy at the city, state, and national level. A lot of our emphasis is at the state level because no matter who is president, a lot of policy gets set at the state level and because there's plenty to improve. So if you stay afterwards, which I hope you do in the parish hall, you'll have an opportunity to pick up this handout, which shows our legislative agenda for the brand new legislative cycle. You'll see the array of issues that we work on. through town halls, through direct advocacy with our elected officials, through community forums on information, et cetera. If you ever saw one of these cards near the voting polls last fall, that was us informing neighbors more about ballot questions. So we work on the advocacy and community education in all these different ways. We have a couple of new projects, voter registration and some progressive parents who want to talk about how to help little kids understand what's going on in the world. So if you're interested in any of those efforts, I hope you'll sign up to be on our mailing list and feel free to chat with me afterwards. And I know that one of our other steering committee members is here, but I think in the other hall at the moment. So thank you very much.
One last set of messages before we hear from our speakers. I'm Claire Barker from Theodore Parker Church's Racial Justice Task Force. Absolutely thrilled to be here. Our conversation is going to go like this. Carlene and Martin will talk for some time. We'll then have Q&A from the fixed mic here, and Mark Bauer will sort of coordinate people getting up to the mic and asking their questions for Martin and Carlene. At 6:30 or thereabouts, we'll have a reception with food and drinks in the parish hall. We invite you all to come there, also to talk to the different organizations, RISE and Progressives, who will be there. All donations today, there are baskets at the exits and in the parish hall, all the donations will go to Black Lives Matter Boston. The session is being audiotaped and videotaped today. And we encourage you to silence your cell phones, but feel free to tweet away. And we are delighted to welcome Martin and Carlene.
How are you all? My name is Martin Henson. My pronouns are he, him, his. My colleague and I are from Black Lives Matter Boston. Just trying to get a scan of the room. You know, I think there's a lot of times when I go out and I look around and I make sure that there's not somebody pointing a gun back at me in the crowd. It's a real thing. It actually happens. So that's what I'm doing right now. I don't see anybody. It was like they plan on starting to shoot right now. So if you do plan to do that, make sure we speak first. And then I'll be ready to go see God then. Because it's real. It's real. It's the everyday thing that we go through. It's an everyday struggle. I have to wake up every day and think about what I'm putting my life on the line for. I get upset sometimes when I look out and see faces who can't understand what I go through, who can't understand what the people who are locked up in prison go through, who can't understand what black, queer, transgender people go through, who are here just to feel good for the day. I don't know if that's you. It won't change what I have to say to you because my mission remains the same. But I want you to know that I'm thinking about it, that I'm aware that there are some of you who pretend, some of you who act as if there is concern in your hearts, in your mind, when there is not. Some of you who actively work and collude with the systems that oppress us on an everyday basis. I know, and I'm not fooled, I know that some of you are sitting out there. I know that some of you are not that, but those particular people will not question those, will not stop those who will act in that way. And I know that some of you are out there who may do some work. You might. We'll see. So when you have thoughts and feelings that occur to you throughout the course of this conversation, I want you to grab that and hold that, regardless of whether or not you think it's appropriate or not, and be ready to ask that question. You know, unlike what a lot of people say, some people say there are no stupid questions. There are stupid questions. But since we are here sharing our time together, we will answer them for you. Hopefully, Carlene feels the same. I will answer them if she is not willing to do so. So that's some of the ground I want to make sure that we're clear on and we're clear about. I'm not doing this as a favor. It's a part of the dignity and respect that my people are so often denied that I have the privilege to do this. So I do it. But I owe you nothing. But I do owe something to the people who are struggling. It's not just the black people who are struggling. There are those people who suffer from the same intersectional woes that we do. So I want you to be aware of that. So are we straight on that? Okay. So Black Lives Matter came about after the death of Trayvon Martin in 2012 at the hands of George Zimmerman. I often say, I don't know how many people have lost a child or lost a loved one to something that feels senseless, but that's an understatement. If we're thinking about what it's like to have somebody killed on the street for having Skittles in their pocket and some iced tea, well, what do you say to that? So one of our founders so brilliantly said that Black Lives Matter. That was the hashtag that came out of that. So from that, artists and organizers and activists came together, her and two other black women, two black queer women out of that group started Black Lives Matter. So there's been work that came from that. So in 2014, when Mike Brown was killed and there was an uprising in Ferguson, there was a call that was put out for activists and people to just, everyday people, to come out and help, offer what you can, contribute. Because it was hot out there. It was, a lot of people were having a hard time. So people in Boston got together, a bus full of people, and went down there. And from that group that came back came the Boston chapter of Black Lives Matter. And after that, I came on a year later, so 2015, so I've been here for a couple years or so. So from that, I tend to go into what our principles are. And as a man who occupies, a black man who occupies a certain level of privilege in the world and understands the things that black men in our community have done, being a part of that patriarchal system, I always say that we are queer and transgender affirming first. It's one of the first things I say. And make sure that people are aware of where we center our focus and our efforts. We believe that if we center the most marginalized people of us, then that makes room for all of us. And generally, I can get a feel of the room by how people respond to that. And the response here was pretty tepid. So I don't know what type of group you all are working with, but it says a lot. It says a whole lot, because sometimes people don't, not an acknowledgement at all. Sometimes you see a lot of heads in the crowd, but the response that I'm seeing here concerns me. So thinking about another one of our principles, black women. Black Lives Matter came from black women. A lot of times there's a tendency to erase the work of black women, to render them invisible in favor of a straight black man who is perceived to be charismatic, who was perceived to be appropriate for the type of work that we had to pick up. And I'm here to say that's not the case. The position that I'm in, the opportunity that I have, was afforded to me by these courageous, amazing black women who decided that it was time to do something about it. And they're in a long line of a tradition of black radicalism that started Black Lives Matter and definitely won't end after they're long gone. Another thing that we focus on is that, and we talk about, is globalism. Black Lives Matter is around the world, 30, 40 some odd chapters, all doing work that is contextual to their community. As we know, or if you don't know, white supremacy is global. It's made its way around the globe, transnavigated on boats, ships, planes, TV, in any way that you can think of. So there has been a struggle that has come from that. And people have used Black Lives Matter as the mantra to continue that work. We are intergenerational. There are all levels of ages that are involved in this work. People bring their children, and sometimes you see a grandparent, a parent, and a child all there together at the same meeting, because it doesn't make sense to remove anybody from working towards something that they are always affected by, whether they're a child or not, because racism is pervasive in that way. It's longitudinal. to use another term for it. So we make sure that we acknowledge that. Within that, there are black villages, people and communities that are not just biologically connected, people who love each other and care for each other, that have decided that they want to step into this work. So we acknowledge and make room for all of that, because we know that we are more than just a nuclear model of mom, dad, and child. They're all different compositions of families, and we make sure that they are acknowledging that they're present within the work that we do. We are inclusive. We make room for black people of all different nationalities, creeds, sexual orientations, gender identities, levels of ability, whether they are formerly incarcerated or incarcerated, whether they're sick or they're healthy. And any other thing that I forget to mention, there, when we first came over on the boats and came across the Atlantic, they took the ones of us that were deemed too rowdy, deemed too sick, too problematic to bring over, and they tossed them over. So when we're thinking about the way that we build a justice movement, we don't toss anyone over. Everybody's coming. We're all going to get free or nobody's free. So that's the idea, one of the ideas that we bring into that. And one of the main ideas that we bring into it is that Black Lives Matter chiefly is a philosophical and ideological position towards a constant threat and invalidation of black life on an everyday basis, every day, whether you're awake, you're asleep, conscious or unconscious, and whatever denotes your position in the world, racism doesn't sleep. And it's always affecting you. It's always going to affect everything that you have, you own, or ever hope to build. So we have to do this in this way. With that being said, we are unapologetically black. That means that I don't have to explain to you my position or apologize for being black. I do it out of a courtesy of my heart so that we can be clear. But if I didn't want to, I wouldn't. So I want to make sure that you all know that. I want to make sure that we're all clear about that, because sometimes people think when they come out to these things that they are owed something, that I'm supposed to make you feel good. That's not what I'm here for. I'm not going to do a jig for you. Those days are long gone. Even though people wish to return us back to those, I'm not doing that. So I want you all to know that. And this is kind of where I'm at, my entryway for a segue to my colleague. Thank you. And we'll talk more later.
Good afternoon. It is wonderful to be here. I am delighted and thankful to our sister pastor here, Claire, the wonder Anne. Yes. I am a mom of a 4.5-year-old, a grad student. I don't sleep, and so half my brain cells are just not working, so please forgive me. But thank you so much for creating and opening your home, your spiritual home. Thank you. There he is, speaking of home. This is Lion, and I was going to warn you that any moment now, but here you have it. And thank you for taking time on this gorgeous Sunday afternoon to come out and have us gather together and listen and share. I'm grateful for my colleague Martin, whom we are in struggle together, and we aren't gonna stop. As we say, we ain't gonna stop until our people are free. But this wager that I'm going to engage today is to suggest that yes, we're going to talk about Black Lives Matter, and yes, we're going to talk about the work that we do, and yes, I'm going to talk about the lingerie of work and struggle that began on the Gold Coast of Africa ever since our people were snatched or sold and brought across the Atlantic. There has been resistance to this kind of indignity and dehumanization, but let's be very, very clear that this wager isn't just about the fact that we will struggle and persist and to continue to exist in order to be free and to affirm our dignity. But I also want to offer, for those who have not yet considered it, what needed to happen for human beings of equal sacred worth and dignity to be so self-dehumanizing, to go and snatch other people from their home and bring them to a strange land as a part of an economic project is just as equally dehumanizing. And so this project isn't just about good people coming to help the oppressed and those who have been marginalized and dehumanized by a violent system that oppresses them, but you have to understand that your liberty and your dignity and your humanity is also at stake. How many of you believe that white supremacy is a real thing? Thank you. I'm so half my work is just about done, and that is correct. That Black Lives Matter is a project that is a continuation of what we know of this lingerie of struggle and what we, many of us, and all of us really, have heard and know about the civil rights movement, the movement of King, the movement of Ella Baker and Diane Nash, and as Martin alluded to, that multiple identities participated, but only the male charismatic figure is centered, and that this current iteration of that movement is directly tied, but in this manifestation is very different because we're in an age where we have to recognize the sacred dignity and worth of everyone in our community. And so, yes, it is organized by women, queer women, poor women. The movement is made up and open and formed and constituted by every segment of our community. And to be very, very clear, the system of white supremacy then operates and feeds off interlocking systems of global power that includes militarization. It includes capitalism. It includes cultural hegemony, what we call cultural hegemony, right? And I'll talk a little bit more about how that systemically manifests itself through every system in our society, including the church. Because our story goes back to 1492 when we're talking about cultural hegemony and when we're talking about designs and collusion of violent occupation and militarization of native bodies, colluding with what then was a religious ideas, imaginations, and institutions, right? And so, but in various iterations and how that has been constructed, as one who studies theology and am a part of the church, I have to say that because I do think Sunday mornings remain still the most segregated hour in America. Mm. How many of you are of the church? This or any other, okay, a good bit. And how many are just community member, who are not just, but how many are community members? Fantastic. This is a great group. And I fail to acknowledge RISE, who also worked to co-organize and partner in this effort. So why do we do what we do? It is a moment in which many people are becoming conscientized and waking up and feeling a sense of imminence because somehow the election of our current person in the White House. Person I will give. Personhood I will give. Does not somehow reflect how we imagine ourselves to be. Right? And I put an emphasis on imagine. We've always been a violent settler colonialist project. We've always not included certain bodies, certain people, certain segments of our population in this great imagination. Some of us had gotten very comfortable with the status quo. For some, reproductive justice meant access to primary care and services and abortion, right? While for others of us, right, and many of these rose up after the election and took to the streets, while since the death of Trayvon Martin and before, those of us who have been community organizers for all our adult and some adolescent and working lives in our communities, advocating for economic justice, advocating for housing, fighting against racist teachers and educational policies, fighting against gentrification in our communities, right? But all of a sudden, now that certain particular women and certain bodies and communities felt the threat and the rollback was coming to your house, then it necessitated rising up and taking to the streets. For us, reproductive justice has always meant not only access to high quality primary health care services, not only access to birth control, not only access to safe and affordable abortions, but that if we choose to bring lives into the world, that yes, we have that health, perinatal health services, but that we can feed our children healthy foods, that we can provide safe and have access to housing, that we can know that our children will go out in our communities without being targeted by occupying forces in our communities called police, who are targeting them, who are profiling them. That our children will have access to education and the remote possibility of growing and living to fruition, to flourish and access purpose. That our children can grow and live in dignity. For women of color, for black women in particular, reproductive justice has always been about the life cycle. Because many who would advocate for reproductive justice would also support the school-to-prison pipeline. Always also hold the imagination that somehow black children are more criminal and deserve to be criminalized more than other children. That somehow there's more crime in our community than there are in other communities. That we will not label Wall Street thugs or the bankers in our communities or those who are corporations and developers who come in our communities and marginalize and displace and cause poverty and displacement in our communities. These aren't thugs. Those who are occupying the current government aren't thugs. But Mike Brown was a thug. Eric Garner, in this imagination, was a thug. The kids on the street, and don't get me wrong, as I said before, we are from day one have been organizing and forming nonprofits and working even before the nonprofit industrial complex, quite frankly. I won't put that on the backs of black communities, but we have organizers and workers in our communities, churches, and people in our communities who are fighting and struggling and working against violence and fighting for education and fight. Again, this resistance and this work has always been the case. So typically what we hear is, why are we focusing on police brutality when in Chicago or in Roxbury or in Mattapan or Dorchester you have black-on-black crime? You want to know what the answer is to that? Just so you know the next time you hear it. More white people kill other white people. More Asian people kill other Asian people. Every segment of a population that you can think of, they kill their own disproportionately more than they kill other people. Yeah? So why is it then that we normalize this trope and somehow imagine that poor people, poor black people, are more criminal and predisposed to criminality than any other group of people? One answer might be the cultural bias, the media tropes, the narratives that you've been presented with, the dominant narratives of this culture. Another of that I would offer is going back to where I began. White supremacy breeds fear, right? It's self-perpetuating. So one of the first things that I'd like to offer in terms of addressing the consciousness of this national identity that we see manifesting is that white people are the first victims of white supremacy. White supremacy is a delusion. The idea that a race of people, any race of people, is superior to any other race of people or group. Racialization is a whole other workshop. But that idea in and of itself is delusional, and it is a lie. When then one constructs this lie, what Emily Towns called a hegemonic cultural imagination, right? Then one has to create the modalities and the mechanisms like the plantocracy, enslaving people for labor to produce economic benefit and to build wealth. Have a system of violence which is militarized, dominant power that extracts, that dehumanizes, that controls, that manipulates, and that uses violence as a mechanism of control. And culturally, you have to perpetuate the lie. So you have to erase the narratives of indigenous people. You have to erase and keep at bay the narratives and the stories of people of African descent. You have to make up lies and create dominant tropes about immigrants, about Muslims, about anybody that is an other, that doesn't serve your purpose, and that doesn't perpetuate and collude with this narrative. Right? And then it has to also reproduce systems at every level. Micro, meso, macro level systems, interlocking globalized systems of hegemonic oppression, extraction, planting military bases all around the world to protect what is at stake, to feed. And I call it a beast. Monstrosity is generous. Right? And so when we begin to think about how this system perpetuates itself and insulates and creates structures, it is no accident or coincidence, not even by sheer numbers, that certain communities remain segregated. Redlining is a real thing. All of these other systems collude. education, access to capital, access to job, high paying or at least livable wages, cultural hegemony where you property value of white people is more important than the livelihood, life, and well-being of people of color or anyone perceived to not belong. Property value is more important to white people. And when I say that, I'm talking about a nationalistic and cultural value. And it goes back again to the very foundations and construction and imagination of what was never a real democracy. Never. I would like to then talk about our presence here. Right, some of the language that that I reject is that we're here to humanize the struggle of all the people my colleague mentioned, humanize the struggle of black people, humanize the struggle, humanize black people, humanize queer, differently abled, non-gender conforming, poor people of any stripe. We're not here to humanize anybody. If there's humanizing that needs to be done, and this is true for any of us, anytime we allow this hierarchy of humanity to efface our own dignity, when we can be complicit, when we can be bystanders, when we can have and hold privileges that we deny to other people, I suggest that the humanizing that needs to take place is us. And so, yes, Black Lives Matter exists to continue the resistance of people of African descent to a particular social movement, through a particular social movement whose imagination of democracy, the way in which all of our humanity and dignity are honored, it is inclusive. That is the movement of Black Lives Matter. Whether you understand or believe what the media has told you, or don't know what you don't know, or don't know what you don't see, know this. Our struggle is to create a democracy that lives up to the ideals of what it means that everyone has inalienable rights to life, to liberty, to access, not pursuit of it, because for some of us, generation after generation after generation, the unearned privilege that white people got, it wasn't a pursuit, it was domination. The wealth that some still benefit from, and this nation as an empire still benefit from, was from stolen free labor off the backs of black people. Whiteness gives unearned privileges. And others of us receive undeserved disadvantages. So I will stop because I'm mindful of our time, and the most exciting part of this is conversation and engagement. But my question to you is, what exactly is whiteness? What is that? Has anybody ever thought about that? Where are your people from? You know, black folk, many folk, you know, oftentimes this comes up. I'm Jamaican. I'm an immigrant. You know, my... Well, we can have the conversation if you'd like. But where are your people from? I know that at first when the Irish came, they were Irish, and, you know, they were the N-word for a long time of white people, and then eventually they just became white. Everybody who has, you know, like lighter hue, who are vanilla, as Dr. West would say, you know, of the lighter sort of Anglo-European, you know, whiteness. Like, you can... regardless of where you come from and what your positionality and subjectivity was from Europe or from wherever whiteness exists, long you come and you just kind of can roll into whiteness. Not everybody fits nicely and neatly into whiteness. For the rest of us, what it creates is a double consciousness, because you have to subject yourself to this universalized system of education that erases you and effaces you. Your culture is not welcome. Your language is not welcome. Your knowledge is not welcome. There are different modes of thinking, being, and doing. Your wisdom and all that your people have done and given to civilizations and societies might get a sentence or a paragraph, if that, in the history books, but there is this central narrative that is a cultural, historical, hegemonic thing that just pulls everybody into whiteness, and some of us, in order to survive, has to have this two-ness, and we have to not only know whiteness, but we have to try to hold on to a semblance of this thing that is our humanity and our dignity and our richness and all that we bring to the conversation and the table, right, in order to exist. So we know what it's, what Du Bois calls double consciousness, in order just to survive. I sit in a graduate school in a classroom where this pains me, because in order just to be there, it is true that we have to be twice as good to get half as much, or to be perceived even as belonging there. But when the conversations and the boundaries of this limited understanding and knowledge comes up, my white colleagues don't know what to do. They are dumbfounded. They've never been exposed. They've never been taught. They don't know Black history. They know Martin Luther King. They know the I Have a Dream speech. Many have never heard of Ella Baker. We never see James Baldwin on the syllabus, Richard Wright, integrated into, you know, and I'm just speaking from this narrow perspective, but there's some in Massachusetts or Boston in particular, not Massachusetts, in Boston, people of color, of immigrant and African-American descent, but generally populated by the immigrant, are going to be the larger part of the population in Boston. The conversation isn't about, well, how do we then look at and redesign and reimagine an education system and be really inclusive, right? But we keep these identities marginal. What I'm saying is that the education that my colleagues are exposed to is lacking and wanting and insufficient. It creates insecurity and fear, and they are not equipped to engage a world as global citizens, but more importantly, as human beings who can live with difference, who can engage it without feeling insecure. So my second point is that white supremacy, first, is constructs this system. Secondly, it creates this very vulnerable, fragile, right, people and imagination. And then everything else has to keep that protected, safe, secure. This thing called whiteness has to be protected. It is so fragile. Keep those people out. We don't develop intimate and personal relationships with those people. Why? Who are the other? Why are we so afraid of the other? And know that I understand that in this moment we can't do it alone. We cannot We cannot do it alone. You cannot do it alone. We have to start building bridges and forming coalitions across these boundaries. And your work, whether it's at your kitchen table, whether it's in the boardroom, whether it's in your classroom, whether it's in your nonprofit, whatever organization that you belong in which you have power to raise the question, to not be a bystander, to interject and to do something countercultural. That's your work. Yes, we want accomplices. We don't want allies. This moment is way too serious for allies. We love y'all, allies. When y'all get it together, you know, and you got lots of people around you to help you, that's not our work. There's a difference, and we're happy to do the training if you invite us, and we'll go deeply in terms of doing a training and a workshop and do some deep dive in terms of the difference between what it means to be an ally, what it means to be accomplice, what it means to be a freedom fighter, what it means to be in solidarity, right? Invite us, get your group, and we're not going to do it for free. Happy to do that work. I believe we cannot do it alone. The history, the information, the books, we've done a lot of production. Trust, there are so many hidden figures. So many dimensions to our movement, to our lives. The knowledge production is mind-blowing, I promise you. The culture, not as a voyeuristic project, not that you can go into a Black Lives Matter meeting or any other space where you find people of color and pull out your black card. No, no. Then we can come together when doing some due diligence, doing some work. Ask for resources, yes. Right? That education is there. But we do have to come together and start figuring out, what do we do with this thing called power that we have, that we all have? What does it mean not then to center whiteness, white self, white ways of thinking, being and doing, white modes of understanding in a room with other people who might have other ideas and ways of thinking, being and doing, who lead, who can co-lead and who can share? What does it mean to be so self-reflexive and so self-aware that you're mindful of your internal double consciousness, what you've been taught versus what you're unlearning and what you need to relearn? That's a serious project. That's some serious work. It's good work. It's liberative work. What am I saying? Ultimately, that our liberation is bound up to one another, but when we come to this movement, we come together understanding that you're not coming to liberate or to save us, but that your dignity and your humanity is inextricably bound to mine. Okay, I'll stop there. So, now Martin talked about somebody that might have a gun. I don't even receive that. but so now we'll open it up for a conversation, for your questions. Please be sure, if you have a brief context to offer, then do so as quickly so that we can get to your question. We'll take stack, so maybe three questions at a time to enable us to perhaps get everyone's question in and then address it. Did I forget any other ground rules? No. All right, and there's a mic here, so please feel free to come to the center of the aisle and ask your question.
My name is Madeline. I'm a member of this congregation. Is this working? Okay. Some time ago, I was at a meeting of Jobs Not Jails, and Reverend Paul Ford stood up and said, tonight there's a meeting of Black Lives Matter, and I'd like you all to come. So a number of us went, and when we got there, we were told, we're not letting in newcomers tonight. Okay, I could respect that. Went home. Sometime more recently, there was a request on the internet for people of all races to apply to be part of Black Lives Matter. I filled out the rather lengthy application and never heard anything. So I'm ready to work. My question is, how do we do so? Because those two situations made me feel kind of unwanted by Black Lives Matter. And I'm not coming to lead. I'm not coming to liberate you. I'm coming to be a humble participant, not an ally. I like the word accomplice much better, thank you. But I'm kind of at a loss as to what to do.
Thank you. Any other question?
I'll say just a similar issue. Hi, my name's Eric. I live in Jamaica Plain. And not part of the congregation, but I've been going to some meetings from some groups lately, like a breakout for Black Lives Matter Cambridge with Didi and Surge, J.P. Ross, a new chapter, and some other organizing meetings. And what I've found is that white people trying to organize themselves are having difficulties understanding how to proceed, like to be accountable to people of color and what types of things they ought to be doing to be maximally effective and so forth. And I don't know if that question can be settled in one room at one time, but it seems that there is a lot of energy that I've noticed at those meetings and just from the previous question that there's a lot of desire to help and be involved in ways that are material and make a difference. And maybe some of us feel like it's not enough to just be aware of our own power in our daily lives and how we can redirect that power to people of color and so forth. And we want to do something on a more movement-oriented level. Maybe it's okay not to have to do that. But in other words, what should we be thinking about doing that's most helpful to people in Boston who are organizing groups led by people of color to help Black Lives Matter and other groups who are trying to dismantle white supremacy? Sorry, that's kind of a long-winded and all over the place, but you get the idea.
Thank you.
I'm John Campbell. Along those same lines, there are racist policies in Boston that I would like to get rid of. And stop and frisk, the broken windows are two of them. And I haven't seen a great deal of effort to stop those except the ACLU. And I would like to be part of a movement to eliminate those from Boston. And I wanted to find out if Black Lives Matter has any program for eliminating the institutional racist attitudes of the way police act in Boston.
Which question? Go. You take a stab at it, and I don't know the references.
Okay. So there was a woman who mentioned the Reverend Ford and the Black Lives Matter thing. I don't know anything about that, so I don't you had to send us something through an email to figure out what's happening there, because I don't, if it's not black people talking about Black Lives Matter, you need to be asked some questions, okay, in terms of like organizing an event, and it's not very clear that Black Lives Matter is involved. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. In terms of the, you know, putting in an application and you know, saying that you want to do work and not hearing back, there is this thing that happens a lot of times. When we talk about racism and white supremacy, talk about what people can do, things that are happening, and when we talk about all the different levers and switches, ways in which black people have to deal with those systems, maybe economic, political, educational, scientific, religious, international. Or maybe we'll break it down into, let's say, economic and say, well, here's what the jobs look like, that black people are more likely to be pushed out of or not have the opportunities to be a part of. And then maybe we might get into talking about what your particular job that you work at is like and what you should do there. But what I find is that, and I don't know if this is happening with the woman who came up, what I find is that there's a reluctance to figure out what that work is on your own. So you haven't heard back from Black Lives Matter. Okay. I'm so sorry to have offended you. But what is real out there is that you have every opportunity to plug into the system in the way that it is to do the things that you feel like should be advocated for. Everybody knows that there's a Senate, a House of Representatives, and if you have a problem, you email them, you show up to their office, and you make sure they do what you ask them to do. Or if you have an issue with your child in the school board, you show up to those parent-teacher conferences and make sure that teacher knows exactly what your grievance is. Or if somebody's bringing in a new school in the community and you don't want that to disrupt what your everyday process is, you figure out a way. But now we're talking about this. Black Lives Matter needs to contact you and put you to work. I can't do the activism. I can't do that consciousness building. I can't seek out opportunities for you to get yourself involved. I'm not doing that. That's one way and one means to be involved. But the everyday, can you talk to your partner? Can you talk to your child? Can you go to your school and talk to them about the fact that they don't have any black people working there? The everyday, people can't do that. I'm just so hurt. They come up to us and they say, I'm so hurt about racism. I'm sorry about what your people have gone through. These are real words that people will come up and say after these talks.
That's not what I said.
I'm telling you how I feel. We owe you nothing. But we owe you nothing.
Okay, look, don't go back.
And that's clear to anybody else. Like I said in the beginning, we're going to work to build the world that we feel like we should live in. And if you want to be a part of that work, you should do it. But like I said very early on, so I didn't have to come to this, is that people don't owe you a pat on the back. People don't owe you a seat right next to us as we do this work.
If I please come and we'll certainly answer your question, or sir, you can ask your question once we've completed. So, yes, we do have time for more questions, but we're answering the first three. So, it is important, and Martin is speaking to this, that self-reflexive work that I talked about earlier, it helps and enables one to be grounded in one's own sense of being and one's own commitment to the struggle for justice and liberation for all people. There isn't one way to do the work. There isn't one thing to do. I can't speak to why a particular individual or anyone didn't get a response. Trust me, it has been so busy. Many of us are, we do multiple things. We have families, we work full-time jobs. I'm a full-time grad student. There's so much happening. And I'm not even saying that, and we're still in that process of getting back to everyone that responded to that call with us. There's Black Lives Matter Cambridge. We can't speak to what Black Lives Matter Cambridge does. We're a separate chapter. We support each other. We're interlinked. We're part of a network. But we are we're a different chapter. So anything they do, it's just different. We're reaching out to Metro Boston areas. Cambridge has founded a chapter, and they're developing it in their own way. But there are multiple tiers in terms of building and structuring the Black Lives Matter organization, and we're still in that process. There is space and room for folk who want to learn or become accomplices and freedom fighters. What we're saying here, and it gets to your question as well, we don't take lightly your taking on the capacity of that self-reflexive work, self-education, taking on a project in your own backyard, organizing in your own spheres of influence. Eventually, that's exactly what it comes down to, is that what are you doing in your own communities? What are you laying on the line and putting at risk among the people who will rip you apart the way that they rip us apart? Who will profile you and target your children for having Black Lives Matter sign? Who, when we put out a call for you to come and flank us when we're doing a march or when we're doing some action or when we have a policy that we want to get through and we know that you're going to get backlash because we've been getting it, let that not be the first time. So if you don't get an email back from us in a time that you feel and in a way and we're not operating according to the standards and your timeline and your expectations, let that not be an indictment or your anger or your rage or your frustration be an indictment on us. That's the time for you to do your self-reflexive work. We want you to come to the table. And we're going to figure out how to do that together, right? But again, what I'm emphasizing is that we want you to come to the table understanding that your liberation is bound up with ours, that you are just as pissed off about white supremacy as we are because you too are a victim of it. That's the bottom line. You want us to come and have an intimate time where we can dig deeper and design and talk about modes and ways of building coalition and understanding and organize a workshop in your community. Invite us, pay us, make sure you get folk to get your dimes together. We set our cost, by the way, and we'll come and do it. We will put our call out. There are meetings that are Black Lives Matter only, that are people of color only, that are Black people only. There's a need, a great need to organize white accomplices. If you're on that growth process, wonderful. We're all in a process of growth. We recognize that. But we come to this space with a particular ethos that is reflexive, that reflects that self-reflexivity, that humility, an openness and curiosity to learn, a willingness to listen and hear each other and grow together. We're coming having lost, losing, in struggle, can't go from point A to B without not even coming here, without being followed, being profiled, worry about my child in school, worried about all of these issues that are happening in our community imminently every day. So we welcome that posture in our freedom fighting work. Did I answer? I have your question. So we got the question about coming to the meet to the newcomer. I can't speak to Dee Dee and Black Lives Matter Cambridge. We just cannot do that. And organizing, again, if that is something that's near and dear and passionate to your heart, there are people doing organizing in Boston, people of color. But also, if you feel that there's more to be done around broken, you mentioned racist policies in Boston. Boston is, what is it now, the second, third, maybe back to one, most racist city in the country. Still. It still is. But it's very educated, very liberal and progressive. Really, very sophisticated, very activist, but still racist. Ask yourselves these questions, and those are the places where you can gather, you can organize, and begin to work. And then when you are doing that, invite or come in at the points of entry where then we can pool our power together and mobilize together. But make sure, again, I can't say this enough, that if we're leading and we're calling for you, that you're willing to flank. That you are willing to flank. Right after the Women's March, we did a talk similar just to this, and a white woman came to ask a question. It's important to note she's a white woman. She said, you know, we marched and the police were there and they were relaxed and they chatted to us, they waved at us. They put on a pink hat. She actually did say that. But when you all march, they're, right? They started as slave catchers. That's who the police are in black communities, slave catchers. The system then has evolved to being occupying police forces that profile and shoot and kill and stop and frisk black people. Running away, sitting, reading a book, selling cigar, whatever it is, driving while black, just being black, shoot and ask questions later. So no, they're not coming to dance with us and to wave at us. And she's like, what do we do? And she wants us to tell her what to do about that. What do you do about your racist police? When do you get to dismantling and abolition of the police the way we know it? That's the language. When do you get to prison abolition? Because that's where we are. We do believe in restorative justice, not a system that is meant, that is the new Jim Crow, the new plantocracy, free prison labor, capturing black and brown bodies for profit and free labor. When do you say this is not reflective of my humanity as an American, as a white person, or not in mine? When do you organize yourselves to do that? And so when we put the call out for you, you come knowing and being willing and ready to pay the price. Are there any John Browns? Okay, I'll stop. Next set of questions.
Elderly person, I think it's the white man's problem first, and I specifically recommend people in this crowd do something specific, particularly if for this particular issue, it's been an issue for 300 years, Black Lives Matter, work for a Boston Civil Liberties Commission to protect people, especially black people, if they're arrested. I've been through it personally, and we need a strong commission, so work with your city council to have this commission set up to review any arrests, of, especially of black people. That's my recommendation for this miss down there. Don't worry if you're not admitted immediately into some group like that. Do something about it. Thank you. Do something. Please listen to yourself. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I have a few dichotomous ideas kind of rolling around in my head as far as educating white folks about white supremacy culture, how we participated in it, even though it's not intentional, and, you know, the need to be accomplices, and hearing how do we then kind of touching on your idea of humanizing ourselves, how do we enter into that discussion without centering whiteness? Because that's a thing that happens all too often with white folks.
No, go ahead. I just have a point of clarification. Yeah. Entering into that discussion with whom? Among yourselves?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, you have to center whiteness.
Okay, so centering whiteness.
In order to demythologize it, you have to center it. What is it? That's the question that adds. But go ahead. I don't want to cut you off.
No,
I just needed to understand.
Perfect. Thanks. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. That was a great question as well.
I really appreciate your willingness to be here and talk about. I don't know why. Oh, okay. Better. I appreciate your willingness to be here and receive much of our ignorance. And I say that because I am one of those people who, after Trayvon Martin was killed and I heard about the Black Lives Matter, the phrase, I had to reflect. My reaction was, my life matters too. Everyone's life matters. And I spent a lot of time thinking about it, and it actually became really critical to my being able to move another step and understand. I had to reflect a lot about my own story, which, of course, involves being white, but my story of birth, etc., and realize that my life does matter, and that's a separate story. This is a movement that's about something else. It's not about I don't matter or he doesn't matter. And the other thing that I'm hearing is that maybe instead of how can I be part of your group, I know there are a lot of groups in Roslindale, West Roxbury that have been forming Surge and Rise and the other things. We've been reading a lot. In 50 years into my life, I read Du Bois and others just in the past year. And I wonder if maybe our role is to continue being part of Surge and learning and being a group that you can tap to say, now we need whoever's available, come now. Rather than how can I come to your meeting and join you, maybe I need to say I'm here when you want to call on me and my group. I don't know, but that feels right to me, listening. So thank you.
I do you have something?
I think that was amazing. I really liked that energy. That answer was perfect. To your question. So I would encourage others to, if you are willing, to have a conversation with you afterwards about what you meant. Only if you are willing, if you're free. She says she's free. So if anybody's confused, see, what's your name? Alta. Alta, you're a great person, Alta.
So I agree. Thank you for walking us through that. You scared me for a minute with that All Lives Matter thing coming. I'm so glad you walked us through it so wonderfully. And what you did point to, which I am deeply grateful for, is the place in you that began with, well, my life matters, with something that was significant and dear and precious to you. And I imagine as you can think about others in your life whose life matters. And that got you seemingly to some kind of empathy and connection to another person, another human whose life also matters, right? When you discovered that we weren't saying your life don't matter. It's that we're saying that Black lives matter as much as every other life. Right? And that our reality has been that that has not been the case. That this nation, since its founding, did not believe that indigenous life mattered just as much as its founders. When it stole bodies from Africa and enslaved Africans, we were not human. Our lives didn't matter. Right? So thank you. I really appreciate that, because what this process does, that self-reflection and that thinking through to the next sort of logical conclusion, is it begins to titillate some kind of empathy, right? Some pathway forward to then learning and hearing and listening and organizing and reading and maybe even watching some very difficult historical material. Some very, very difficult realities, both past and present, in talking about that. I do, however, move us along the trajectory of development and as an evolution as people, as equal human beings. Eventually, we have to be able to come together. We have to. So yes, Surge is here to organize and to do some of that work. Surge calls us in, and Surge is a group who want to be accomplices, who want to learn how to be better in solidarity, and some want to move to being freedom fighting. There are spaces where we all can come together and be in the same room and plan an action. I do it across movements. From indigenous rights to Palestinian rights to Black lives, from housing rights to education, we have to build coalition across lines. Our power together matters. So we have to get to that place. Surge is in service to white people, but not a segregationist organization, right? And eventually they're not there to remain a mediator between us and them. But there is some work to be done. And as I said, the work that might be done together, that we can help, some of us, now I can't speak for all Black Lives Matter or even Black organizers. You won't get the time of day from some people if you're asking to come and talk about and educate. Some of us do that as a calling, as a profession. It's a skill, it's a joy. Right, for some of us to do it. Some of us won't do it, which is fine, because all of us are tired. Very tired. But what also adds to the exchange is if you organize, you bring a group of wonderful people together like this, organize a training, pay for it. Time and labor. Right, is a real thing. We have so much work to do and never enough resources to do it. And in some cases, yes, it is economic resources. That's a part of the problem. In other cases, it's other kinds of resources. We're organizing a books and breakfast. We need partners to, you know, get our wish list, the books that we're doing in the community. We need partners to order books or gather appropriate books. We need partners to maybe, you know, cross a congregation to get us a warm, to figure out how to get us some juice and some milk and some fruit and some warm breakfast sandwiches and just deliver it. Here's the address. Could y'all do that? Organize, figure it out, and could you just drop it off? You know how huge that is? Yay, see us after her. There's so many ways. The film, if you all are showing 13th or I'm Not Your Negro or any other film and you all want to have a discussion and it's important to understand different perspectives than your own internal sort of knowledge and questions. Yes, I'll do that. I'll come. I'll sit with you. I'll engage those conversations. There are others of us who will do it. But do that work. Organize it. Is that clear? Okay, great. Mama Belvy has a question, and I want to make sure that you get your question in.
Is that it's both a question and to just say to all of you who are here that I grew up, that I'm standing here because I grew up in spaces like this, the Unitarians, the Quakers. And what I learned in those spaces in San Francisco, where there weren't an awful lot of young people who looked like me, I actually chose to go there because the conversation was about peace. And it was a conversation about integration. But interestingly enough, when I walked in here, I realized this was one of my homes. That this was one that and that for me, what I learned, which has very much kind of been important, is that I learned from in spaces like this, from Quakers and from Unitarians, that there was a lineage of progressive white people. In my working class community, I did not know that. And so part of what was kind of really, really very, very, and I can't stress how important, so whatever it is that allows you who are part of a larger lineage of struggle inside this country. And I think part of what I learned in those spaces is that you often didn't know that. And that fortunately I was in spaces as a teenager where, in addition to supporting Dr. King, I learned about who you were and that lineage that you were part of. And so I just want to, in the context, you have a long, there's such a long history of struggle, and we don't know, our history is not taught, but that part of your history is not taught. That taught this. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows that the way John Brown is taught is he was crazy, right? So I just kind of want to say that I left my church because I had always been told that when you got to be 13, Jesus did something. He made some decisions. And the decision I made, because the church, the African-American church that I was growing up in San Francisco, was not as progressive as the Unitarians and the Quakers down the streets in terms of the larger social issues. And so it's really extremely important for you to understand your history, because your history has had a profound influence on my political, social, and so reaching out, I was 14 when I went to the Unitarian. So reaching out and having discussions, the great question seminars that we would sit around and they would take us out under the stars to discuss the meaning of life is extremely important, because that's part of what you do, but being inclusive. So I just want you to know that I always kind of, when I walked in and I said to her, this is where I grew up. And my family was Methodist, but I said, I'm going to go up there and talk to those people, because they're talking about strontium 90 and peace and a whole lot of other things that I didn't understand.
Thank you. I guess we've come to the end, or?
This might be our last round of questions. Any other questions for Carlene and Martin before we adjourn for the reception?
Please come to the center. And while you come, I want to give our email, boston@blacklivesmatter.com. I always get it mixed up. boston@blacklivesmatter.com. Our PayPal, if you are so moved to donate one time or monthly or however you want to do it, give financially, it's m4blmboston@gmail.com. Again, it's m4blmboston@gmail.com. That is our PayPal. My email address, if you want to email me directly, is Rev, R-E-V, K-A-R-L-E-N-E, @gmail.com. Rev Carlene @gmail.com. I liked that Mama Belvey brought up the abolitionist movement, and certainly we're in an area where, you know, abolitionism, there's a legacy of that, and certainly throughout this narrative. And I think that's really, really significant, and it's really important. I'm a part of the UCC Church, and we talk about that history regularly. And we talk about it in terms of the work and liberalism and progressivism that exists. And what we also talk about is the reality that what we need now is to also strengthen that legacy in recognizing the full and equal humanity of people of African descent and all people. We don't talk about that part of it, but here in this moment, we're going to do that work. How many of you all watch Underground? Oh, if you have not been watching the series Underground is what it's called, I highly recommend that you all can get it on demand, Netflix, DVD. Hulu, it's called Underground. I highly recommend that you watch that.
Thank you being here. Are there any last questions? I think not. We will have time for questions in the parish hall. Just follow us through the breezeway. Thank you.
I see a hand here. Is it a question?
Can you come to the mic, sir?
Yeah.
My name is John Sano, and I'm from Roslindale. I was wondering, is there an opinion on the new kind of effort to charter schools? And I wanted to know how you're feeling about it and how your group is feeling about it and how we should be feeling about it, because I've always felt that there should be strong public schools that bring everybody, every citizen together, and I'm absolutely opposed to supporting charter schools. But if you find it's good, maybe I should change my mind on that. But I don't see that. I see on the TV that it seems like, you know, people in the inner city, you know, the more black parts of Boston want charter schools. Is that just brought to us by the white media?
Wow. So I'm policy-wise, in terms of Black Lives Matter, we can talk one-on-one about that. Generally speaking, can anybody out there who's doing anti-charter school activism speak to him? Anyone? Okay. That's all I'll say. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll see you in the parish hall for conversation and food.